Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With school, childcare, sports, family, every child in this country has been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. When it comes to the virus itself, we've learned a lot in the past year about how it affects kids and passes between children and others, and we're learning more all the time. This hour, we're going to talk about COVID-19 and kids and vaccination. Now that the Pfizer vaccine has received emergency use authorization for kids 12 to 15, many teens in Iowa are already getting vaccinated. You are welcome to join the conversation this hour. Have your kids had COVID? What was it like? Are you one of the parents eagerly getting your teens vaccinated? Tell us why. Do you have some serious questions about vaccinating teens? Call and ask them. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. And with me this hour, two pediatricians who have treated some of Iowa's youngest COVID patients. Dr. Joel Waddell is pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. Hello, Dr. Waddell.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Also with us, Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health and St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Dr. Ching, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
And I want to start with some of the basics. As I mentioned earlier, early on in the pandemic, it became very clear that children were not in the highest risk categories. And early in the pandemic, children really weren't even getting tested for COVID. Tests were scarce and testing children was not a priority. So, Dr. Ching, why don't you start us off? Now we know a whole lot more about COVID-19 and kids. Let's start with the basics. What do we know?
What we know about COVID in children is that for most kids, it remains a fairly benign infection. That being said, there are populations that are more vulnerable to developing severe COVID. And as time goes on, we are getting more clarity in which populations of our children are at risk and how COVID affects them, and also which children are at higher risk of COVID-related conditions such as multisystem inflammatory disease in children.
Well, and multisystem inflammatory disease, that's something that we started seeing fairly early on in the pandemic. It seemed very mysterious and terrifying at first and still is very frightening. What is it?
So it's a syndrome that was originally believed, it's a system syndrome of inflammation in different organ systems that initially was thought to be similar to an illness known as Kawasaki disease. But since then, as we've seen more of it, we've been able to pick apart differences between different types and different presentations of it, and we've been able to have more information on how best to treat it. Dr. Waddell would be a great person to take this from there.
All right, Dr. Waddell.
Yes, like Dr. Ching said, it's a very serious illness. It usually happens a couple of weeks, 2 to 4 weeks after an initial COVID infection. So a lot of kids we see have asymptomatic disease and go on to develop multisystem inflammatory syndrome. And so essentially, what happens is, the way I like to think about it is, the child's immune system responds to the virus and then just kind of never calms down and then continues to cause inflammation in all the organ systems. And so we have to combat that inflammation. Children are often admitted to the ICU, and one of the most worrying signs is they will require medications like epinephrine, or better known as adrenaline, to keep their blood pressures up. And so we have to aggressively treat this inflammation. And so to treat it, we use multiple different anti-inflammatory therapeutics kind of simultaneously. One's called IVIG, which is it's just a lot of antibodies that people have donated, not antibodies to anything in particular, just kind of your common cold viruses. And then we give that to the child. We also give them systemic steroids. And at times with severe MISC or MISC, we have to give them even further anti-inflammatory medications.
Once the, with children that you've treated, once the crisis is over, what does recovery look like?
So it's pretty remarkable. What I love about my field is these children are quite sick, sometimes requiring multiple medications to keep their blood pressure up simultaneously. They usually are in the hospital for a week or so, often in the ICU. And then when they go home, for the first week or two, they're quite fatigued. And then by the time I see them about a month and a half after their hospital discharge, most of them are back to where they were before, or back to their normal. However, some of the children who suffer from MISC still, as of today, have ongoing symptoms and complications from MISC, the most common being essentially heart failure, where their heart doesn't squeeze or pump blood as much as it's supposed to, and they require medications to help their heart pump appropriately. And we don't know how long that's going to last, because this is a new syndrome. It was only first described in April of last year. And so they have to follow with heart doctors and get multiple follow-up imaging studies and stress tests to see when, if, and if their hearts are going to go back to normal.
So lots and lots of questions. Can you give me an idea of how many patients you have treated for this multi-inflammatory system disease?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number, but probably around 15 or 16 here in Des Moines. But that those children don't just come from Des Moines. They come from kind of all of central Iowa. And then talking to my counterparts at the University of Iowa, they probably have similar numbers, 15 to 20, in the past year.
And are these kids of all different ages?
That's a good question. And kind of like Dr. Ching was alluding to, it's a little different than Kawasaki's disease. Kawasaki's disease, we usually see it in preschool age kids or maybe young elementary age. But MISC often is teenagers. So the individuals who are now eligible to receive the vaccine and maybe middle school age kids. So your infants, your young preschoolers, MISC is not very common in that age group.
Okay. And we do know that three children in Iowa have died of COVID-19 in the past year, all under the age of five. Obviously, that's a low number, but it's, you know, you don't want to lose any children at all. Dr. Waddell, if you were talking to parents right now about the risks of COVID-19 for their children, we do know that a lot of kids, if they get it, they kind of have the sniffles or a mild cold, and then things return to normal. What do you tell people, or what would you tell people, about the risk of this virus and young people right now?
You're right that the majority of children who get COVID-19 are either asymptomatic, meaning they have zero symptoms at all, or they have mild disease. They get fever, cough, it goes away. But children do get sick, and children can get severely sick from COVID-19. I have seen many of those cases, not just MISC, but acute COVID, where children have been very sick and hospitalized, including hospitalized in the ICU. It's not a fun thing to experience, and it's hard to watch parents care for their kids in the ICU with acute COVID.
I was just going to ask Dr. Ching if he had anything he wanted to add to that.
Yes. People sometimes talk about COVID as being no worse than the flu. The issue is that the severity of COVID in children is still much higher than that for influenza. The hospitalization rates for children is many times that for influenza. And the second part of it is that children who are hospitalized for COVID have a much higher risk of needing significant support for conditions such as respiratory failure or shock or other components that are part of acute COVID. And many of these symptoms are approach similarity with what we see in the adult population. So COVID in children, especially in teenagers and other children who and children who have vulnerabilities to severe illness, such as prematurity, immunodeficiency, children with cancer, COVID can remain a significant threat to their health. And it's not something that you can easily write off. I've seen, as Dr. Waddell has seen, I've seen quite severe cases of COVID in children that have required ICU care. And it's not a good experience for the family, and I would wish to prevent that if possible.
Sometimes I wonder if this disease had come along and had only affected kids at the rate that it affects kids now, but without the horrors of what it was doing to our older populations. I mean, Dr. Ching, how do you think people would respond if there was this new virus and it affected kids in this way without all of those other things that were going on?
I think, in part, our approach might be a little different and the same, because the measures needed to slow this down would be similar. I think that I don't think the horrors of a pandemic necessarily discriminate by age, but certainly the trauma that we feel as a community, as a population, would be a bit different. I think that we all love our kids, and we would do whatever is necessary to save our kids, just as we would our relatives, our families, our community members. It would be. I agree with you. It would be different, but it would be challenging in another way.
Yeah. Let's take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 and kids. We'll also be talking about vaccinating teens, something that's already underway in Iowa right now. With me this hour, Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health in St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids, and Dr. Joel Waddell, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find 3 new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 and kids. We're talking about what we've learned about how the virus affects children. We'll also be talking about vaccination. I know that vaccination for teens has already started in Iowa. Some parents are very eager to get their kids vaccinated. Others are more wary. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, with your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me this hour, two pediatricians who've treated some of Iowa's youngest COVID patients. Dr. William Ching is pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health and St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Dr. Joel Waddell is pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. And Dr. Waddell, just before the break, Dr. Ching and I were talking about really how concerned we've been about COVID in kids, and maybe how unconcerned we've been about COVID in kids. And I would love to hear your feelings about that as well. Of course, I mean, this pandemic has been so big with so many different elements going on. Do you think that we have given too little attention to COVID-19 in young people?
I think that's a good question. Kind of like you mentioned earlier, initially during the pandemic, we realized that our older individuals were higher risk, and so appropriately focused most of the attention on the high-risk categories. Now, the question of have we paid too little attention to COVID in children, I don't think so. I think that groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, has taken a large lead role in paying attention to COVID in children. The one thing I would say is the AAP and their research infrastructure is not gigantic, and so there has not been a ton of research from larger research institutes like the NIH in children. So that's maybe one area where we necessarily haven't been able to pay as much attention to kids. But overall, I think that the AAP has done a great job at keeping us all updated and informed on COVID in kids.
All right. Well, how about the public, though? Of course, there's a very different world between medical professionals and what the public hears. And for a long time, it feels like we were hearing from our politicians, from our leaders, this message of COVID doesn't affect kids. COVID doesn't mm-hmm. pass between children. I mean, that there was a lot of work that went into kind of perpetuating what I think is pretty clearly a myth. What do you think about that?
I think you're onto something there. Yes. I mean, when the pandemic first hit, that was kind of the messaging that we received from kind of the top down, was that COVID doesn't affect kids, and we now know that that's just not the case. We know that the kids can get severely impacted by the virus, and on top of that, they are severely affected by the pandemic itself. And so, I would tend to agree with your assessment there.
Dr. Ching, did you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I think a portion of that myth, as Dr. Waddell aptly put it, comes from priorities, right? We make a diagnosis of COVID based on a confirmed test. So most of the people who were being tested were people who were sick. And during the initial stages of the pandemic, that was limited mostly to the adult population. Whereas in most children, if a child comes down with sniffles and doesn't feel well, is it mono? Is it a cold? Is it something that they brought back from school? And rarely would a child get tested if a test were even available. The second part of this, as also Dr. Waddell talked about, is that research in children's health is drastically underfunded compared to other parts of medicine. So in terms of medication trials and approvals, as is the case with the vaccines, we're last in line. We're the last people who participate in clinical trials, if we even do. Recent changes in legislation pushing for involvement of the pediatric population in clinical trials has worked towards addressing that disparity. But that remains very much a problem, especially as time goes on, as this pandemic changes, evolves, and persists. It's going to be super important to collect information on how children are affected, not just by acute COVID, but by post-COVID syndromes. We don't know what they are. And also what the effects on their well-being and mental health are. And I think we haven't paid enough attention to that yet.
There have been a few stories in various media publications about kids who have gotten very sick from COVID over the past year. For this program, we weren't able to convince a parent to join us. And my sense is that a lot of parents are really uncomfortable talking about their kids' experiences with COVID. So I have anecdotal stories that I've picked up from people who know people. For example, I know about a 13-year-old girl in rural Iowa who had COVID in January. A couple of months later, her heart rate started spiking, and doctors don't know for sure that that's from COVID-19, but she's now on heart medication. And we have, you know, not only seen these stories about the multi-organ inflammatory syndrome, but we've also seen, and particularly teenagers, getting severe COVID with the symptoms that adults get. And it feels like a lot of parents don't want to talk about this, and you know, I can only speculate why. I'm sure that you know, we all carry around a lot of parent guilt, so there's that worry and worry about blame and worry about any kind of stigma that their children might carry. Dr. Ching, of course, working with children and working in a hospital as you do, you've seen these cases firsthand. So you have a much stronger understanding of what's going on here. So in addition to some of the messaging that we've had, it feels like COVID is kind of invisible among children to the public. Do you feel that's true? Dr. Ching? Well, maybe. Go on.
I think the myth that it doesn't affect children has colored a lot of that. And also the second part of it is that with COVID, the challenge for us as physicians is our toolbox for handling it is not so much optimized, but let's just say refined to address it well, because this is a new syndrome, and especially in children. And our fortunate experience is that children that is the rarity of severe COVID in certain populations of our children, specifically early school age. However, as the physician treating a child and a family who has severe COVID, it's a day-by-day experience. It's a marathon because each day is different. Each day there are changes, and we as a team involving the entire healthcare team as well as the family and the child talk through our options, what we know, what we don't know, and how do we go forward, and what to expect if we can give that advice in the next hours or days. And that's nerve-wracking. And the causes of ICU syndrome or ICU syndrome in families, it's a very traumatic experience. And I have absolutely the utmost regard for families who've been through this and understand the reluctance to talk about it because it's still relatively fresh.
Yeah. And Dr. Waddell, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. No, I would agree with Dr. Ching. I mean, it's a very complex emotional process to go through when your child has severe COVID or MISC. One thing I've noted, though, is so children who have MISC and are hospitalized, I see them all in my clinic for follow-up after they're discharged. And almost uniformly, I can't think of a patient or a family off the top of my head who hasn't said, "How can we help?" Meaning they've all wanted to be involved or referred to research studies on children who've had MISC because they don't want this to happen to other children, other families in Iowa. And I know of a couple who have gone on to their social media accounts or a couple of local news stations and have said, you got to take this thing seriously in children. And so I think that for some families, you know, understandably, they don't want to talk about this significantly, but others want to scream from a rooftop, "Hey, you know, you have to take this thing seriously for your children."
Yeah. Well, and I also wonder about the mild cases as well. I've had several people tell me in confidence, in strict confidence, "You can't tell anyone, you can't tell your kids that my kid had COVID or tested positive for COVID." It does feel like there is a stigma or a shame or just a fear about being open about this virus. Dr. Ching, when you talk with parents, when they want to talk to you about kids and COVID, and they haven't had this personal experience, what kind of questions are you getting from parents right now?
So the questions I get stem from what they hear. It's questions such as, "Is this really that serious?" Or, is this quarantine for real? Does it help? Is physical distancing useful? Are masks helpful? When will there be a vaccine? These are the questions that we get about many other infectious diseases, but tinged with a certain element of this is new, we haven't experienced this before. The closest thing we've come to this is the flu. What's the difference and why should we worry about this? That was in the beginning of the pandemic. And the questions have evolved over time as we've seen different parts of the world affected differently by the pandemic. But many of those questions, especially with regard to the new eligibility for vaccines, are popping up again. And they're good questions.
So are they easier to answer for you now than they were at the beginning of the pandemic?
I think so, yes, because we have more information on how people have done with COVID infections. We've been able to answer questions better with evidence and data. For example, one of the questions that has been asked about COVID vaccination is its effect on women. And now we have a lot more data from different countries that tells us about this potentially severe impact that COVID has on pregnant women, and also safety information on vaccines that have been given to women who subsequently had a child. So armed with that new information, we can more confidently answer those questions.
Yeah, well, and that is one of the questions that you see coming up quite a bit with people who are nervous about vaccination. And we will dive into this more deeply, but just since you referenced it, if people haven't heard these, there are people who are concerned that the vaccine might affect fertility. We have heard quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that sometimes women will experience a heavier period after receiving a vaccination. But we also know that COVID itself is associated with a higher risk for preterm birth. And Dr. Ching, you're saying we're not really seeing that there is a risk to fertility with this vaccination.
So with the evidence that we have so far, and this is including millions and millions of doses given in study populations out there, well, certainly in the clinical trials, of women who received the vaccine, there were no changes there was no increase in pregnancy outcomes or bad outcomes or complications compared to the placebo group. So that is a great piece of information.
And before we dive into the vaccines a little more heavily here, you mentioned all these questions that you're getting from parents, but let's answer a couple of those questions, Dr. Ching. I mean, when they ask, do masks really work? Do these distancing really work? Do these quarantines work? What are we seeing from school districts that are following those policies?
So what we've seen out there is that, yes, so many of these measures come from studies that were done looking at, for example, the mask. A lot of the mask data comes from studies where certain particles were pushed through masks of different kinds. And then, so those are lab studies. But we also have seen since then epidemiological studies, not just on a small scale, where people in certain enclosed spaces experienced a cluster of infections. And they subsequently determined that the people who got the infection were all in line of a ventilation of a stream of air that was being pushed through from the ventilation system. We're also seeing that people who are outside have a much lower risk, that the risk of infection decreases as physical distance increases. So we have progressively better and better evidence confirming that the measures that we have been recommending, such as masking, physical distancing, limitations of the numbers of people in an enclosed space, improvement of ventilation, that these work, not just in the lab, but also in the real world, where one great example that we've seen is a gym that installed a new ventilation system. And they've, as far as I know, as of now, have had zero cases that have been traced. So their machines are appropriately distanced. Everyone wears a mask. The facility is well ventilated, including to the outside, and they've done fantastically well. There are ways we can make this work, and we have good data that shows that that they work.
We are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 and kids. With me, Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health and St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Dr. Joel Waddell, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And when we come back from the break, we are going to be focusing on vaccination. Obviously, that is on so many parents' minds right now, now that the Pfizer vaccine has been authorized to use in children between the ages of 12 and 15. Have your kids already gotten their shots? Call us. Tell us about it. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Here First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Here First today, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 and kids, what we have learned, and we have learned a great deal over the past year or so. And now we're going to focus on vaccines. Of course, we all know that the Pfizer vaccine has recently received emergency use authorization for kids 12 to 15. Many parents are very excited about that. They're making the appointments right now as we speak. There are other parents, of course, that are more nervous or just wonder if vaccines are a good idea for kids in their teens. Do they make a difference? With me this hour, Dr. Joel Waddell, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines, Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health and St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions, with your experiences. If you've already gotten your kids' shots in the last 12 hours or 24 hours, you can give us a call and tell us about that too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Waddell, obviously parents are responding to this in different ways, just as people have responded to the vaccines for adults in different ways. Tell me what your response has been to the news that the vaccine was approved for kids 12 and up.
Joy, honestly, is the first word that comes to mind. Like Dr. Ching was talking about earlier, oftentimes clinical research in children lags years behind the research in adults. And so the fact that we have now, very kind of early into this pandemic, a vaccine that is safe, that is effective for children is amazing and quite exciting.
And how do you think this changes? Obviously, it changes life for families specifically. I have a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old, and I'm also very excited to get my kids vaccinated. It feels like now is when our family will really, you know, start reaping the benefits of vaccination. At least, you know, it will allow us to do things that we haven't been able to do, although we're incredibly grateful that we've been able to spend time with grandparents already because of their vaccines and because of the vaccination my husband and I have received. But how do you think this changes life for families that choose to get their teens vaccinated, Dr. Waddell?
So you hit on some key points there. So it does a few things. So first is, and most importantly, is it protects your child from the potential of developing severe disease from COVID. But then more immediate effects would be it's going to make, I should back up. We have asked a lot of this generation of children. We have asked them to not see their peers. We have asked them to do Zoom classrooms. We have not asked them not to see their grandparents. We have asked a lot of them. And so this vaccine will allow them to go to their grandparents. It'll allow them to stay overnight at their friend's house and go to, in this summer, allow them to go to the camps, you know, summer camps, baseball camps, et cetera. So I think that there is immediate benefit of giving this vaccine, and I think it's going to loosen things up a little bit in terms of what activities are safe.
Well, and Dr. Ching, how does this affect herd immunity? Of course, this is largely theoretical as of yet, but looking ahead, how do you think this could impact the pandemic?
I think this is huge because for quite a few infectious diseases, such as those that we see during the winter or those there's other ones that are seasonal, children are a very big reservoir for the virus. So basically, the infection goes to children. Children pass it amongst themselves. Frequently, the children don't necessarily get super sick, but then they can pass them back to other populations. So having the ability to vaccinate children, and let's note that the efficacy of this vaccine in the trial is amazing. Of the children who received the vaccine, zero developed COVID. Zero.
That's incredible.
And for the safety of the vaccine, there were no serious events that were related to the vaccine. There were no clots, no serious allergic reactions, no Bell's palsy, nothing that had been feared that could have come up when we were looking at expanding the eligible population for the vaccine. I mean, this is incredible. And the ability, just like Dr. Waddell said, to return to normal activities is the biggest thing. I mean, I'm a molecular biologist by training, and this technology is a dream. The ability to generate a vaccine that targets the virus so specifically with such purity of its materials is unprecedented, and the ability for our kids to get together again, to run around, to sleep over, to go to camp, to go to a theme park without needing to distance, without having to quarantine for 14 days. These things are game changers that will do so much to restore normalcy for our children and our families.
We have some parents who have questions and also want to share their experiences. And Richard is on the line in Dubuque, I think, with one of the most common questions. Hello, Richard.
How you doing?
Good. What is your question for our doctors?
I'm really curious on how they can claim the safetiness and the effectiveness on a so-called vaccine that hasn't been out for very long.
Okay, let's not call it a so-called vaccine because it is a vaccine. But Dr. Ching, I know that is a question that a lot of parents have. It was developed very quickly and tested very quickly. And I will just throw in here that one of the reasons that it was able to be tested so very quickly is because of the prevalence of this virus. If the virus had been less prevalent, it would have taken longer. But there's been a whole lot of COVID around. But Dr. Ching, respond to Richard's question.
So the safety questions look at different types of events. And the concern is, was this developed too fast? Was the testing done too quickly? And the answer to that is that most side effects or adverse events will happen within the first 60 to 90 days of administration of the vaccine. This has been the case with pretty much every vaccine that we give to children and adults, as far as I know. So the fact that we haven't seen this in our trials so far is very, very encouraging. And we continue to perform surveillance. So anyone who gets a vaccine, the CDC maintains a database through VSafe and tracks all of this. The recent concern about a rare blood clot with the administration of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was caught by this surveillance mechanism, which tells you that it works. And that we haven't seen this is very, very encouraging. Is it 100%? We can't say that. That's impossible. But I am very hopeful and reasonably confident that as time goes on, this safety track record will be borne out. And if there is a problem, if there is an issue, we will catch it and address it. But out of the adolescents who have received the Pfizer vaccine in this trial, that we haven't seen anything serious is very encouraging.
With the vaccine, I know a lot of people have done quite a bit of research trying to understand what mRNA vaccines are, and we are talking specifically at this point about the Pfizer vaccine. You mentioned the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but that has not been approved for anyone under the age of 18 at this point, so that's not really in play at this moment. But when you look at the Pfizer vaccine, Dr. Ching, help us understand. You talked about really how miraculous and clean this vaccine is. Explain what that means.
Sure. So typically with other types of vaccines, there are many different kinds. So the idea behind the technology behind a vaccine is that the vaccine causes a certain antigen to be presented to the body so that the body recognizes it as foreign and develops an immune reaction to it. And then subsequently, when presented with the real thing, it's already been primed, because typically an immune reaction can take weeks to fully ramp up. So this is kind of the, shall we say, like a practice run for the body's immune system. So the way an mRNA vaccine works is that mRNA is messenger RNA. It is a sequence that in the routine operation of the body is what the body makes from DNA and then is translated to protein. So the normal progression is DNA into mRNA into protein, and then the protein does its thing. With the vaccine, it's a specially designed mRNA that encodes for a spike protein. And the spike protein is one of the main antigens in the SARS coronavirus 2 virus. So the idea, so that with this, there's only one protein that is that the vaccine tells the cells that where it's injected to make and present for an immune response. The other components are several different lipids that make a little bubble around the mRNA so that it can be transported and appropriately taken up by the body. So it basically means that instead of a mix of different antigens, there is only one that is presented.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Jody is on the line in Ames with a question. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
What is your question?
Trying to get encourage my grandson a little more to get the vaccine. I am in my mid-50s. I have a couple of immune deficiency diseases. I have a rare blood clotting disorder that is genetic. And I got the vaccine because of what COVID could do to me. And also, you know, I don't want to be the spreader of it. My grandson is 13. He has a couple of pre-existing conditions. And I would highly encourage him to get I am encouraging him to get the vaccine, but he has a lot of reservations. And I'm trying to teach him also to make his own rational decisions. He's 13. He thinks he wants to be a dad someday. And so he's heard from other people that, you know, it could cause some kind of reproductive issues. And also, he, you know, it hasn't been approved by the FDA, so he doesn't want to be a quote unquote guinea pig. And so, I don't know. I guess that's just, I don't know how to encourage him that it's safe. You know, I also am a lab technician, so I have a little bit of understanding of this mRNA stuff. So, anyway.
Well, that's a great question, Jody. It sounds like you're doing a good job answering questions. Dr. Waddell, what would you say to Jody?
Yeah. So when it comes to the safety of these vaccines, it should be noted a couple of high points. Number one, the Pfizer vaccine has gone through the same safety trials and the same safety stop points that every other vaccine has gone through. It seems like it's gone through quicker. I mean, it has gone through quicker, but it doesn't mean any safety shortcuts were taken. Usually when you have a vaccine development, you go through a phase one trial and you invest millions of dollars, and you don't start phase two until months or years after phase one is completed. You don't start phase three until phase two is completed. And here the federal government, in addition to private companies, invested billions of dollars in every phase of the trial simultaneously, so there was not lag period like we're waiting to distribute. And so it would not go through the FDA and the CDC. They would not approve these vaccines for use in children if it was not safe. And so it is safe for children. And the other common question I get, and kind of alluding to the previous caller, how do we know there's not going to be long-term side effects? There has never, in the history of vaccine development, there has never been a vaccine developed where a long-term side effect was only seen years or decades later. It has never occurred. And so the fact that we've already seen that it's safe in children and adults means that there's no scientific reason or historical reason to think there's going to be long-term side effects we have not reached. And more practically, speaking to a 13-year-old, doing this vaccine is going to let you do the things you like to do. I mean, it's going to let you get out and meet with your friends and continue going to classes.
It also sounds like an opportunity maybe to talk to a family doctor and get those questions answered by somebody they know and trust. Dr. Waddell, does that make sense to you?
That makes 100% sense. I think our family doctors, our pediatricians, they're kind of the boots on the ground. Like you said, you already have a relationship with that provider. Call them, talk to them. That's what they want you to do. They're begging you to call.
All right. And Deb is on the line in Wilton. And Deb, your child just got vaccinated this morning?
Yes, it's been such a long wait for this. Our whole family has been vaccinated since January because we're essential workers and healthcare workers. But my 15-year-old daughter with severe asthma, it's been so hard waiting. So as soon as I heard that it was going to be approved this week, I started calling, making appointments, trying to get an appointment, and explaining to the pharmacist, yeah, I know she's not approved yet, but she'll be approved by Wednesday. And so we almost didn't make it today, though, because she got a fever a couple days ago, and we had to get COVID testing for her, but she was cleared. And now we got that first vaccine in the arm, and just can't tell you how excited I am about that.
Oh, Deb, that's fantastic. And I know there are a lot of kids excited to get a shot for the first time in their lives.
Yes. It's like the beginning of life again. We can start breathing again. We don't have to fear that something horrible is going to happen to her if she gets COVID.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for your call and congratulations. I'm glad you were able to get in. And Dr. Ching and Dr. Waddell, thank you both so much for being here. And this does feel, Dr. Ching, like a really exciting moment.
I'm so thrilled that we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel and our ability to protect our children and our families. We feel so relieved and also hopeful that we will get back to normalcy with vaccination.
Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point Health and St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Waddell.
You're very welcome. I would echo the signs of hopefulness for our children.
Oh, thanks a lot. Dr. Joel Waddell, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.